Paddy Gibbs.
Okay, cheers. A talk about Noel Pearson, but also I think, his thought, but I think, you know, a bit more importantly, the sort of political context that is around the rise of, you know, Pearson and Pearson-like figures as, you know, leaders or so-called leaders of in Aboriginal affairs, the growth of influence of the ideas of Pearson. So I suppose just firstly to introduce the context that we're operating in. There's currently an intervention going on in the Northern Territory, which people probably know about, where the Racial Discrimination Act has been suspended, allowing the operation of explicitly racist laws to be implemented on Aboriginal people. And to give you like a little bit of a snapshot of what that looks like, I've been living in Alice Springs for about the last 2 months, and the first day I went to put my Centrelink form in, because I didn't have a job at that time, I lined up in a queue that said put your forms in here, that had four other white fellas in it. And to my right was a queue that was 16 people long that was all black fellas, all Aboriginal people. Right, and that was a queue that was set up for people to line up for the income management system to get the ration cards that they're distributing as part of the welfare quarantine and the intervention. So this sort of open segregation that's actually taking place that arose from and is flowing from this policy. We made a fuss about that, wrote letters to Centrelink as part of the campaign and got that sign removed, but that, you know, that visual image that, if you can just imagine it, is what's happening, you know, across the society, in many, many different ways as a result of this policy. Another example, we got off the stalls that were running at Centrelink there. A man came up to us who is working around communities in Tea Tree, which is north of Alice Springs. And there, people are being sent boxes of groceries, rations, instead of receiving their entitlements. They've complained about this and they've been told in no uncertain terms that this is the way it's going to be. There's nothing you can do about it. You have to get used to it. And, you know, as he said, you know, these are communities, people who've done their own shopping and developed their own systems of, you know, getting food for a long time. This has completely disrupted that. The meat's arriving green. You know, they're packing detergent in with the other food. They're not actually providing, the things that people are asking for. They're just sending out boxes of rations, which is essentially what was done in order to get food to these communities, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. And that's what is being expressed, is what's happening is there's being a return to the ration days, a return to the assimilationist and paternalistic policies that were in place before the struggles for self-determination that we'll talk a little bit about today. I think sort of going alongside that, you know, on the ground you can see that really, really explicit racism, really, really explicit return of hard colonial relationships of control, domination, segregation. Going alongside that is the rise of ideologies, racist ideologies, you know, associated with these practices and justifying these practices. There exists a think tank currently called the Bennelong Society, who people might have heard of, but they held a conference on June 21st, which is the anniversary of the intervention, as they called it, the anniversary, something to be celebrated, that was attended by all the leading intervention bureaucrats, whether it was Major General Chalmers, Sue Gordon, all the people that are running the intervention, as well as the architects of the intervention, such as Malbrough, etc., going along to this Bennelong Society conference. And there, the papers that are presented, you've got to understand the explicit racism that is in these papers. It is Aboriginal culture that is responsible for the problems in Aboriginal communities. It's breaking Aboriginal culture. It's forcing people to leave their land. It's forcing people to move into cities. That is going to be the answer to the problems that are facing Aboriginal Australia. This is said clearly. This is said explicitly, and this is accepted by the very, very high levels of policy development and policy implementation, you know, in the Australian state. Talk about Pearson, they're doing a historical reprint series, the Bennelong Society. And the first one in their historical reprint series came out in August this year, which was they're reprinting a paper that was written in 1966, what they said at the height of the assimilation era, before the nightmare of self-determination sort of descended on the population. You know, this was written by workers. It's called, you know, Preparing Aborigines for the Modern Workforce. It was written by workers in the Northern in the Northern Territory at the time, and the paper says we're reprinting this because we need desperately to return to the work of 1966. It must start again. There's been this disrupted period where people have, you know, of rights and of self-determination that's been an absolute disaster, and we need to return back to the work of 1966. And so they've sort of, you know, published this paper. But it's in this context, I think, we need to understand the return of this really, really explicit assimilationist racist ideology at the high levels, that we see Noel Pearson emerge as a leading figure as he's presented to Australia, a leading figure in Aboriginal affairs and of the Aboriginal people. I think it's, you know, really, really important to distinguish the way that Pearson's presented from the reality of Pearson's relationship with Aboriginal communities, because the anger at Noel Pearson out there in Aboriginal communities, actually on the ground amongst people, is absolutely palpable. The amount of times I've heard people threaten violence against Noel Pearson, you know, if he comes here, what he'll receive from us is, you know, it's just that anger is really deep-seated and really, really palpable. You know, that we can't assume for a second that Pearson is in any way got any sort of organic connection, you know, or has arisen as a leader out of the Aboriginal community and has large amounts of grassroots support. That's just not true, you know, and people who do, you know, doing work with Aboriginal communities will know that level of anger. This is someone who has been cultivated by the ruling classes in Australia, by the Australian press, by the Australian government, and presented to the country and presented to Aboriginal people as a leadership figure, rather than, as I argue, someone who's sort of emerging, you know, whose status has actually come from, you know, has actually been earned and arisen from those communities. So if you have to look at Pearson's thought, we just look quickly at some of the components of Pearson's thought. I think the first is, you can see this classic conservatism, a real social conservatism that is based around blaming the victim for social problems. So any problem that exists has got nothing to do with the structure of society, has got nothing to do with the circumstances that person might have been born into or been forced into or whatever. Any social problem results from the behavioural choices of that person. And it actually gets quite boring reading Pearson. You know, I've read a lot of Pearson for this talk, but every single question he trots out the same old line. So whether it's alcoholism, the people have just got to take responsibility, got to just stop drinking, they just got to stop it. You know, he's viciously rips into any of the studies that have been done or any public figures that have come out giving social explanations for alcoholism, given any models for trying to move away from alcoholism that are about changing the structural conditions that people live in or providing social support for people that are affected by these problems. Vicious against those. It's the person's fault. They've just got to stop drinking. Whether it's the conditions of houses in Aboriginal communities, you know, it's got nothing to do with the massive overcrowding. It's got nothing to do with the lack of services that are provided to actually fix up those houses. It's got nothing to do with racism. It's about people have just got to take responsibility for their house and start painting them more often and start doing the repairs themselves. And it's that, you know, they've just got to take responsibility for this problem and they're going to overcome it. And it's, you know, time and time again he trots it out. And, you know, real in there is this deeply, you know, we recognise in conservative thought the value of work. You know, if it was only people were forced into work and were doing more work, you know, it doesn't matter what it is, fruit picking, fruit canning, whatever, as long as they're working hard and pushed into this situation, all the other social problems that are around will fade away because people will be involved in this, you know, virtuous process of actually doing work that will provide the discipline that they need and that's lacking at the moment. So first is that classic social conservatism. The second is a neoliberalism. Real commitment to the private market as being the way that social problems are going to be overcome. So the problems around Aboriginal housing, for example, like I say, have got nothing to do with government neglect. They've got everything to do actually with government's minuscule amount of government support that's been provided. The problem is that it's public housing that a lot of Aboriginal people live in, and the solution is actually privatising all those public housing assets, making it so people own their own houses, are buying houses to rent to other people. You know, is going to be a way out of, like, people sitting in this room probably realize, you know, how you know, out of this world it is, the idea that we would buy a house that we would rent to someone else, you know, as a way of getting ahead, you know, getting ahead in life. But, you know, very deeply impoverished Aboriginal communities, this is going to be the way that they get ahead. And that, you know, there's this really, really serious commitment to the free market, which we'll sort of come back to. The third element of Pearson's thought, I think, that I want to take up a bit more substantially and look into, is his approach to racism and the question of racism. It does tie in, but in terms of the social conservatism, there is also, you know, and it also ties in with the racism, there's also a very, very strong paternalistic element. So on the one hand, it's true that people have got to take responsibility for themselves, but on the other hand, the only way we're going to get them to take responsibility for themselves is putting really, really harsh, punitive government controls on people that are actually going to force them to take responsibility. We can't rely on it. We're going to force them. And it actually draws very, very heavily on a lot of the thought that's coming out of the United States, you know, around welfare reform, a lot of the neo-paternalistic thought that developed in the United States, you know, through the 1990s, that justified, you know, wide-scale attacks on the welfare system in America, that actually introduced a lot of the measures that we're seeing in Australia now, in the design of either the welfare reform project that's going on in the Cape York or in the Northern Territory intervention itself. And one figure, Michael Mead, who is an American theorist, who's brought out to Australia by Pearson's Cape York Institute for their conference, is an absolutely classic line from him about the approach that I think these people are taking in the conference papers. He says, "Aboriginal people must be bound before they can be free." That's the line that he uses, and I think actually really, really sums up what is going on in terms of the policy. And it's very much the reforms that are being put in place in the Cape York are very, very much about binding Aboriginal people. So Pearson's designed and is in the process of implementing what's called a family responsibility commission, which people have got no rights. Vis-a-vis this commission. You can't go there with a lawyer. You can't appeal the decisions that are made. You can't challenge the decisions in any way. They have enormous powers of surveillance. So, you know, access to police records, access to school records, access to Centrelink records, access to everything to actually, you know, spy on people. Yeah, things such as paying your rent a week late warrant report to this Family Responsibilities Commission. You know, things that I think a lot of people in this room would also be familiar with. You know, warrant report to the Family Responsibilities Commission. And it's this commission which will make decisions about how people's welfare is going to be spent if they're deemed to be someone who is, you know, like a social deviant or someone who is in need of taking responsibility will be controlled by this commission. Now, this is slightly less repressive than what you see in the Northern Territory, where everyone in an Aboriginal community that's on a welfare benefit is subject to the kind of controls that you're seeing in the Family Responsibilities Commission. But like I said, still a massive attack on people's civil rights, still very much about binding Aboriginal people before they can be free in the terms that are being used, and requires the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act in Queensland, anti-discrimination legislation, it also needs to be said. So that's the sort of approach by Pearson, both philosophically and practically, in terms of what he's developing. But yeah, I'll just go back again to the question of racism. It draws very heavily, when he's sort of explaining racism, again on American theorists, these sort of conservative Black American theorists that have emerged. Not organically from the Black community, but, you know, very much tied in with a ruling class offensive against warfare, against warfare. That'd be nice. Against welfare in the United States. Shelby Steele is someone he quotes at length in an article that Pearson actually wrote on Obama. And you get this sense that racism, again, it's not structural. There's nothing in our society structurally that leads to racism against Aboriginal people anymore. There used to be a situation where people were excluded from citizenship rights before we had the referendum, before we had these sorts of things. There was a racism that was structural. But all that was overcome by the civil rights movement, both in America and Australia. So all that's behind us now. Everyone's got equal rights now vis-a-vis the state. Where does the racism come from? It's actually all in our minds. right? It's all in our minds. And the people who are responsible most are Aboriginal people themselves, who continue to think that their position is because of racism, and continue to you know, articulate that they're suffering racism, and continue to talk about racism, and that's where racism comes from the minds of Aboriginal people. It's very, very clear, you know, and the solution is to stop talking about racism and it'll go away, and start pulling ourselves up. By our bootstraps. But this also leads to a particular approach to the state, you know, and I think, you know, that you can see very, very clearly in Noel Pearson. That is, you know, obviously the state's got nothing to do with racism, because as we've explained, this is an idea that's in people's heads. The state is something that is a progressive force that Aboriginal people just haven't understood how to use the state properly, how to get inside the mechanics of the state, how to sell their ideas to the state and to conservative politicians. And if only they put their arguments better and had a better understanding of the workings of the bureaucracy, etc., the lot would improve. And so Pearson, you know, is very much, it's all you can see from the early 1990s, it's been sucking up to the government, trying to get, you know, sitting on government boards, trying to get things, you know, and I think most recently you see this, oh, there's going to be 50,000 jobs for Aboriginal people by early next year because of the grace of the corporate sector. The richest man in Australia has, you know, has come to his senses because Pearson's talked to him enough, and he's going to provide 50,000 jobs to Aboriginal people, which firstly, yeah, anyway, is an absolutely ridiculous proposition, but the political approach that it's taking is very, very clear, where it's about actually sucking up to government and putting your arguments in a way that government can understand, that is, you know, basically lining up with them and being the Aboriginal face of their attacks on the community. But I think we've got a very, very different understanding of both racism and the nature of the state here. And I think you're just wanting to talk, you know, to some extent about that. And I think it's actually only by looking at the particular structure of the Australian state, the historical development of the Australian state, and the needs of that state for the production and dissemination of particular ideas, that we can understand where the Northern Territory intervention has come from, and we can understand where the ongoing poverty that's actually faced by Aboriginal communities and oppression by Aboriginal communities actually comes from. And the first thing to say, I think, is that we need to talk about the colonial nature of the Australian state. It's a settler state. Its foundation is built on racism. Its foundation is built on violent dispossession. Is built on mass murder. Is built on the clearing of the frontiers. The state itself, from the moment that it landed here and attempted to establish the Australian colony in two ways. Firstly, it's coming as an outpost of the British Empire, with all of the racist ideas about white supremacy that are bound up with that, and that are justifying British imperialism. But secondly, you know, even to begin to operate in Sydney Cove, you know, particularly when it's about trying to establish some sort of industry here, you need confrontation with the local people, you need homicide against the local people, massacre against the local people, and going along with that, you need a particular set of ideas about their inferiority, about, you know, the supremacy of the settling society. So in the very genesis and the very ongoing structure of the Australian state and the Australian government that we're all living under is an anti-Aboriginal racism that has been required for the dispossession, has been required for the actual process of settlement. So I think that's a very important sort of thing to understand when we're trying to understand where Aboriginal racism comes from, and also why there is, you know, such conditions that people are still living in. But I think on top of that, you know, as well as understanding the particular process of settlement and the violence that accompanies settlement and the ideas that accompany settlement, I think there's very, very much also a need to understand why after the process of conquest has been largely complete. You know, why, I suppose it's the 1920s or 1930s maybe, but certainly 20s, that you sort of get the last... massacres on the frontier, the last sort of open military confrontations over who's going to control this land, etc. You know, but any Aboriginal racism doesn't stop there. You know, actually it takes a lot of new forms. Why is it that after the conquest, if you like, is complete, and that the question of land is in some substantial sense settled? Certainly not by any means totally settled, but in a very substantial sense settled by the government. Where does this ongoing racism come from? And I think, you know, it's very much, you know, from that period up until now, there's been an absolute thorn in the side of the Australian ruling class has been the ongoing, you know, occupation and resilience and survival of Aboriginal people themselves, you know, in very many ways, that continually poses a challenge to the legitimacy of that government and to the legitimacy of the nationalism that's tried to be created by that government. You know, that the project of settlement was one about bringing civilization, that the project of settlement and in the history of Australia is one about constant progress, is one about bringing, you know, a constant development of the economy and the growing of wealth of everyone. The ongoing existence of Aboriginal people in the poverty that they've been forced into, the racism that they've had to suffer, and also the political challenge that they've consistently posed to the government in very various forms, has been something that has been a problem, you know, and is referred to, you know, in this Bennelong Society and others as the Aboriginal problem, has been an ongoing problem actually for the Australian government, one that hasn't gone away, and is one that, you know, is that very much is needing to be dealt with in various ways, least of which, and if we can just get to it after a little bit of recent history, by the process of the Northern Territory intervention itself. So I think, you know, firstly you need to understand, like, that the challenge to assimilation the last time around, because assimilation from the 1930s, 1940s is very, very much a strategy that's used. How do we deal with the Aboriginal problem, this ongoing Aboriginal population that poses, you know, various, you know, challenges that I've spoken about before, is actually, let's wipe them out in various ways. Not the frontier violence, but the stolen generation, you know, the mission camps where people are forced to give up their own culture, the forced migration, this sort of assimilation. It's actually by squeezing and putting enormous amounts of pressure on Aboriginal people, controlling Aboriginal people, forcing them in different ways, we can actually get rid of this population and assimilate it into the broader society. But you get from the 1960s, while this is challenged in different ways, you know, throughout the 20th century, from the 1960s, there's a very, very clear movement that's happening in the context of, you know, and a mass movement turns into a mass movement that's happening in the context of anti-colonial struggles around the world that are rejecting the racism that has justified the conquest and ongoing occupation of all of the different colonies in the world, you know, that incorporates the black power struggles that are happening in the United States, you know, the anti-racist struggles there, the anti-racist struggles in the heart of Europe that were taking place by colonised people. You know, it's in this context that you actually get a very, very clear articulation of the situation that Aboriginal people find themselves in, and a rejection of that, you know, and an embrace of a radical, you know, in many ways revolutionary politics actually amongst Aboriginal people themselves, that pushed against, fought against, and demanded the retreat of the structures of assimilation that had been put on people. So whether it was the protection boards, or whether it was the, you know, the exclusion from citizenship, or whether it was, you know, a whole range of different control mechanisms were actually confronted, and with a broader left, and it's very, very important to understand that this is also taking place in the context, and can't be divorced from, the growth of a radical left in Australia from the 1960s, you know, that took a whole range of forms, whether it was the anti-war movement, the anti-apartheid movement, the growth of a rank and file trade union strength that really, really exercised its power to demand rights for workers, you know, better living conditions for workers, more political influence for workers, you know, taking place in the context of the rise of the Aboriginal movement. And I think we need to understand why is there such a fear of our Aboriginal movement, and why is there such an attempt to crush it, is by looking at this period. Because what the Aboriginal movement offers and is part of in terms of that broader struggle is the absolute horror of Australian capitalism, just laid so completely bare. You know, this system that's sending your son to fight in Vietnam, this system that's refusing to give you wages that'll actually, you know, make it and so you can meet rent every week. You know, this same government is actually living on top of stolen land, is presiding over, you know, massive infant mortality rates amongst Aboriginal communities, is locking people up and murdering people in prison, you know, the deaths in custody that are taking place. That sort of critique, you know, that actually comes from the Aboriginal movement is very, very powerful and sinks very, very deep into the broader left that is actually emerging at that time. And in the early 1970s, at the same time as you're getting workers, construction workers, other workers in Sydney stopping work to attend the black moratoriums to demand rights for Aboriginal people. At that same time, you also see the highest level of strikes actually in Australia, certainly in contemporary Australian history, the highest level of strikes over industrial issues, 1972, 1973, 1974, coincides precisely with the time when the, you know, Aboriginal rights movement is really bursting onto the political scene, and alongside anti-war movements as well. So I think, you know, those things are absolutely wedded together in terms of the rise of a militant working class, a combative political left, and a left which actually understands and is taking up and supporting the struggles that are coming from Aboriginal people. So out of these era of struggles, you get a whole series of reforms that are now under assault. You get the provision of services, whether it's the legal services, legal aid services. You get the granting back of, you know, of land, of the Land Rights Act in the Northern Territory, which grants, you know, large amounts of land to Aboriginal people, and the beginnings of some sort of concessions around land, you know, in the other states. Like I said before, the citizenship rights, and I think very importantly, the sort of attention and funding to services that are actually needed to try and lift people out of the conditions they're in, as well as, you know, anti-racist legislation such as the Racial Discrimination Act 1975, which is currently suspended to allow the operation of the Northern Territory intervention, is sort of passed in this context. But it's also important that while the government says we are going to at some sort of vague level, it's an official policy to say we're going to support self-determination. Actually, the Whitlam government says we're moving from an era of assimilation to self-determination. What the government says is self-determination, the concessions that the government's willing to make, are never grant the actual demands that are coming from the communities themselves. And there's always that constant tension between needing to recognise and provide some sort of concession to the movement that's coming from the left and from Aboriginal people, and on the other hand, not wanting to concede openly, you know, the brutal history of what's actually gone on in Australia, the massive amounts of resources and concessions that are going to be needed to actually address this historical wrong. So whether it was when in the National Aboriginal Consultative Committee in 1973, which was set up by the Whitlam government as part of their self-determination process, voted, well, we want to control the budget for Aboriginal affairs, not you, and we want a massively increased budget, the government threatened immediately to sack the consultative committee. You know, well, if you actually want to introduce any form of real self-determination, you know, you're going to be gone. You know, whether it's the refusal, I think, you know, very, very clear, you know, and important for us in understanding how Labor is governing and Labor's resulting to this to these questions, is that, you know, the refusal of the Hawke government as they were coming into power to put in place any sort of national land rights legislation that had been very, very strongly demanded by the movements and had been actually promised by the Hawke government, refused to put any legislation in place that would grant any serious concessions over land. And actually they backed up state governments in really, really heavily repressing grassroots, pockets of grassroots resistance that were demanding control over land, particularly when those areas were in conflict with, you know, Australian companies and Australian corporate interests, such as at Roxby Downs, you know, over the question of the uranium mine that was being constructed there, Nookumbah and other examples. And this is the problem is we're in a situation now where there is such where there's a consensus at the elite level and in the papers and stuff that self-determination has failed. It's self-determination itself which is actually the problem. It's all these powers being given to Aboriginal people, all this funding's being thrown at Aboriginal people, and look at the devastation that's still in these communities. But if you actually look at it, there is never, ever, and there continues to be, you know, like a denial of real the funding to Aboriginal communities that even the white community enjoys. You know, systematic underfunding, you know, a systematic starvation, you know, of remote areas and holding people in, you know, in urban areas into situations where they're not, you know, where they're not properly funded. So, you know, for example, the one of the men who worked on Noel Pearson's From Hand Up to Hand Out, Philip Martin, he quit because he quit the job of designing the welfare reforms in the Cape York, because he said Pearson's only ever telling one side of the story. He's telling everyone to take responsibility for themselves, when if you actually look in this town, if a tap breaks and you make a call to get the tap fixed, No one comes. There's no one working at the Centrelink to actually hook people up with any employment opportunities that might be working. There's no one working at the Centrelink to actually provide people opportunities for study, to explain the ab study, you know, entitlements that people might be able to have. There's no regular doctor. There's certainly no dentist. The school's chronically underfunded. All the houses are falling apart, not because people are trashing them, but because there's no services and they've got 20 to 25 people in them. Like that picture, if you look at, you know, for instance, the Northern Territory and the communities in the Northern Territory that are derided, you know, as being these, these areas of, you know, backwardness where self-determination led to this disintegration of communities. It's the same situation. I mean, in Central Australia, a lot of the communities there per capita are getting half the amount of funding that students in Darwin are getting for their education. Like, it's just an absolute lie to say that there's ever been the actual resources provided to these areas where people can actually take any sort of meaningful, you know, community development and meaningful control. And actually, if you talk to people anywhere where there has been, a serious program that's actually working, that's actually got Aboriginal control, that's actually, you know, like, is delivering positive outcomes from the community, anywhere there's that, there's also enormous political heat. There's also a constant battle to keep funding coming in and a constant pressure to actually looking at shutting down those areas. So it's, you know, sort of in this context of, you know, like of certainly a continued deterioration, you know, of living conditions into the early 1980s that comes from, I mean, there's gains that have been made, certainly, and you can point to them, even socioeconomic indicators in terms of health, education, etc., improve in the 1970s. But that ongoing denial of any real concessions to the demands from the movement, any of the real sort of levels of resources that are actually needed for communities, you know, sort of, it's true that you get a situation where people continue to live in the poverty and the marginalisation. But, you know, the Labor government is doing nothing about this, making no concessions. If you look at ATSIC, what they set up, set up ATSIC because they promised a treaty and they didn't deliver it. They promised national land rights legislation and they didn't deliver it. And so they set up ATSIC, which initially had an appointed chair, had no teeth, had little grassroots support. I mean, was taken up, people trying to do the best they can with a sort of a nominally representative body that it became, but it's something that was never actually given the power and the funding, was subjected to incredible levels of scrutiny. I mean, if people want to talk about corruption in ATSIC, but, you know, the finance companies, the oil companies, the corporations in the city, you never see the level of scrutiny that ATSIC was subjected to, you know, actually in the multinationals that are sitting here and making profits in the Australian economy. You know, it was absolutely savaged. But you get a preparation, you know, sort of through that period, as I think it's very important to understand, as the left itself is attacked and as the left itself goes backwards, as Labor dismantles the rank and file union strength that existed in Australia through the 1980s, as Labor privatises all of the public services that people had fought for and won, you know, as Labor begins the process of neoliberalism in Australia, is at the same time, like I was saying before, those two things can't be linked. At the same time, you're getting the vicious attacks on the Aboriginal rights movement. And it's with Howard that it takes its most vicious, its most explicitly racist form. I mean, when Howard comes in, you know, from the word go, whether it's over the Hindmarsh Island, you know, Island Bridge, where you get, you know, savage attacks on, you know, Aboriginal culture and refusal to concede anything that people should have access to lands that they've lived on that are important for them ceremonially, etc. Bucket loads of extinguishment they promised for the, you know, very, very small concessions. But native title, you look at native title, it offers, you know, to only 5% of the Aboriginal population the most stunted form of land rights. And even that was savagely attacked by the Howard government. I mean, just a small example, sort of running out of time, but a small example of what native title actually gives you. You know, I'm working in the Northern Territory at the moment. If a company wants to mine uranium on land that you own from native title, and they approach you as a native title owner, they say, you know, do you give permission for us to explore for uranium on this land? If you say yes, you can sit down with them and maybe have a bit of negotiations as to where or where not the mine's going to go, maybe have a little bit of negotiations as to how many royalties you're going to get from that, which will be barely anything at all. If you say no, you can't explore for uranium, They push you out of the way, they explore for uranium anyway, and they go ahead and they dig it up. And you've got no say, no royalties, no nothing. That's native title. You know, this is not any sort of meaningful control over land. And even that native title was stripped back and attacked viciously by the Howard government, the Wick Amendments. But I suppose just sort of finally, I'll talk about the history wars that took place under Howard, because I think this is where it's so important for understanding why the ongoing, you know, existence of Aboriginal people, the struggles of Aboriginal people, if given oxygen and growth and support, place such a challenge, such an ideological challenge to the legitimacy of the Australian government itself, you know, in so many instances because of the history of colonisation, the brutal history of colonisation, they recognise it was very important for the Howard government to absolutely go on the offensive against all of the research that had been done, all of the statements that had been made through the 60s, 70s and 80s about the frontier violence, about the poverty, you know, the completely rewrite history. I mean, if anyone's seen Windschuttle's book, it just completely rewrites history, fabricates it, said there was never any massacres, there was never any, you know, there was never any policy of genocide, there was never anything. You know, this ideological offensive to try and say that the project of Australian settlement has been a virtuous one, it's been one that's about progress, it's been one that's about wealth creation, it's got nothing to do with violence, it's got nothing to do with brutality, as we know that if you look at the history of treatment of Aboriginal people, it's posed so clearly, you know, that the offensive around the history wars can absolutely not be divorced from the offensive around the basic rights that people have actually got, and also the offensive against the broader left, the entrenchment of neoliberalism, the entrenchment of the attacks on the unions. All these things actually come together, and I think that, you know, while we're in the current context of understanding why fighting the Northern Territory intervention is so important in the context of actually rebuilding a broader left. So I think sort of just finally, Pearson himself provides the everything that the government needs. It's Aboriginal people's fault, the situation that they're working in. It's the fact that we've been given any control at all that is the problem that we're in, and is neoliberalism as well. And it's private, industry, it's free market reform that's going to solve the problem, that's going to get us out of this mess. It provides this sort of perfect face for what the government's actually trying to do. But I think what we need to understand is they might be trying to solve now the Aboriginal problem as they see it through a renewed round of assimilation. People are being forced into the urban areas through the Northern Territory intervention. You know, people are being forced to give up, you know, the cultural practices that they're trying to rely on. People are facing more intense racism actually in the cities as a result of this. But this is going to create more problems, more anger, you know, more frustration and more opportunities, I think, for people to actually stand up and fight to expose the real nature of the Australian government, the real nature of what has been done to Aboriginal people, and demanding real solutions that are about respecting people, giving people the proper resources, you know, and fighting together against this, you know, this government which is oppressing and exploiting us all, imposed most sharply, you know, for Aboriginal people in this country. Cheers.